cash, every movie costs $2,184.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Backtracks the Music. My name is Corey Morissette, joined, as always, by everybody's favorite, John Mariano. How you doing, John?
I want to be like Mike.
did you dream of being Michael Jordan when you were a young boy on the East Coast of America?
I actually dreamt of being Charles Barkley more than Michael Jordan. You know, like, if you know anything about me, there's an edge of violence to everything that that goes with me. And Jordan, you know, we got to see in the documentary that there was a violence to the way he went about the game.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a violence to the way Sir Charles played the game. Right. And I'm very much that East Coast basketball, and not that the Bulls weren't the East Coast basketball, but there was a violence to Barkley. There was a violence to some of those 90s Knicks teams, right? Give me Charles Oakley any day, right? Like somebody tearing down a rebound, right? I appreciated Mike. You know, I remember, you know, watching with about a half dozen, maybe a dozen of my friends, watching the flu game in awe of what this man was doing on the court,
yes.
Right? There was no pun intended, because his predecessor was Magic, but there was a magic in the air when Michael Jordan touched the ball.
Oh, nice callback to the movie we're talking about. But see, I was Canadian, so I didn't want to be like Mike. I wanted to be like Wayne. Everybody wanted to be Wayne Gretzky north of the border here. But you said there's a little bit of violence in everything you do, John. I kind of pictured more as being a Bill Laimbeer from the Detroit Pistons, wearing the plastic face shield and just being a total dick.
Oh, that's probably a little bit more accurate to how I was on my neighborhood court. You know, absolutely zero ability to go to the net, but like complete violence when I was in and around the ball.
You right.
Know, perfect for a technical foul any time of day.
Yep. That was Bill Laimbeer. But they haven't made a movie about courting Bill Laimbeer yet, but they did make one about courting Michael Jordan. And that's the movie Air, released this year by Amazon Studios. Originally, it was just going to be exclusive to Amazon, but they decided to put it in theaters too. So it dropped in theaters for a little while, did pretty good, and is now available to stream on Prime Video. And John actually saw this movie first and highly recommended it to me. And yeah, I'm a big fan of sports films, so I gave it a watch. And John, maybe tell us a little bit about Air.
So Air is apparently the sequel to Prefontaine, where they invent the Nike sneaker. They reinvent the Nike sneaker in Air with a I guess spinoff brand, you would call it.
Yeah.
But you know the mid 80s, there was a borderline monopoly on NBA sneakers by Converse. You know, if you were playing in the NBA, you had to wear Converse or close to it, and you know, all the major contracts with all the major stars were going to Converse. Jordan, you know, was projected to be this game-changing player, and you know, he really, really thought Adidas were cool, mainly because Run DMC had written a song called My Adidas.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big hit, and it was really cool, and that was the cool sneaker. And then Nike was third, right? Like, that's kind of, and then there was Nike.
Yeah.
And you know, it's weird to talk about Nike as an underdog, but this film, and you know, we can talk about this film for a while, Corey, but this film and Ben Affleck's mastery of directing, I think does a great job of taking Nike, which we have taken as a dominant brand for 30 years now, and painting them to be like this, you know, up and coming company that is just striving to try to make a name for themselves, because they're basically a running and walking shoe. And all we've ever known from most of our lives is that they're a basketball shoe, because the minute the Air Jordans hit the market, it was the hottest shoe in the world. And they only got better from there. And the dynamic shifted, and all of a sudden Nikes were the coolest shoes, and Converse was later bought by Nike. That's how badly the dynamic shifts. Spoilers for the movie, like, this is pretty much all happens in the epilogue afterthought of the movie in some writing, but this is the actual story that what happened. What the movie is about is brokering the deal to get Jordan, and you know, instead of taking their budget for two or three or four, you know, I don't want to call them mediocre players, but less than desirable players to endorse their shoe for their very small basketball sneaker department, they go ahead and they were Matt Damon's character. I forgot his name, but it's now been about a month or two since I've seen the movie.
Sonny Vaccaro.
So Sonny Vaccaro, you know, within the context of the movie, I believe it was more of a team effort in real life, but Sonny Vaccaro in the context of the movie has this vision of just going all in on Jordan, that Jordan is this game changer, and it's inspired by watching the game-winning shot of the NCAA tournament and the fact that little scrawny Michael Jordan, you know, not only calls for the ball, but that the play that nobody seemed to think was designed for Jordan was actually designed to go to Jordan from the very beginning. It was an out-of-play. You know, we're getting deep in the weeds in basketball here, but look, I love sports. So if you're not here for the basketball and the sports stuff shit, it's a sports movie show today, guys. That's just how it is.
Finish your thought. Here I said no cuts in this show because we're recording Sunday night and it drops Monday morning, and it already I made a moment that needs cutting, but I'm not going to do it. No cuts, John. Go ahead.
So they inbound the ball and they pass it around and they get it to an open Jordan where nobody's really looking that way. And Jordan, I don't remember if it was a two or three pointer, but you know, cool as a cucumber with the game on the line and seconds to go. And now's the shot. And Sonny Vaccaro recognizes this and goes, wow, he's a game changer. He's not just any old player. He was like one of the youngest guys on the court making that shot. And it was designed for him and he knew it was coming. And it wasn't just he like took it and got lucky. It was he knew it was coming. This is Magic Johnson 2.0, or at least that's what they were calling him at the time. They didn't know what was coming.
I want to throw in a couple of stats here because you talked about the coda to the film. And the big thing people will remember, hopefully, who know their basketball history, that Michael Jordan would sign with Nike only on the condition that he earned a percentage of every Air Jordan sold. So just the Air Jordans. And Phil Knight, the CEO of Nike, famously thought, our expectations on this year are about $3 million in sales. So, you know, he would get a percentage of $3 million. That's not too bad. The damn shoe made $162 million its first year.
Yeah. Yeah, Jordan is a billionaire like six times over thanks to the shoe nowadays. It was an incredible deal. It was something I believe it came from his mother. Or at least she's credited with coming up with a clause in the movie. Mm-hmm. But I know that Jordan very much they had brought the screenplay to him. And he loved the screenplay but you got one thing wrong because it was very Jordan centric. He goes, it was my mom who did the negotiating, not me. I was still a kid. And it's like, if you make this about my mom, like, and then he had two stipulations. You make this about my mom. And then he called for the casting of his mom. And my Lord, like, look, give the man what he wants.
Yeah, he said, and you may want to cast Viola Davis as my mom. I think she'd be great. And
yeah.
She was fantastic.
I mean, there was not only was she fantastic, she delivers a speech in this movie that to me is going to be the Oscar beat. That if they're going to push this for any Oscars, you know, there's a couple of moments. Damon has a moment. Viola Davis has a moment. I think you got to play these speeches for the Academy to at least try and get the nomination because it's there. Mm-hmm. Right. Like I was hook, line, and sinker. I was buying into the story. You know, we also have Jason Bateman doing his Jason Bateman thing. Not so much in a comedic way, but in like his supporting, you know, I'll bring up another name that they bring up in the movie. In a lot of ways, Jason Bateman is the John Stockton of this movie, with all the assists going left and right throughout the course of the movie.
And ironic, because John Stockton was one of the players Nike wanted to sign instead of Michael Jordan. And John Stockton, I don't think, sold a lot of shoes. He was a good player. Didn't sell a lot of shoes.
No, he was an excellent player, but he was, you know, he was the Robin to Karl Malone's Batman.
Yeah.
Right. And you're not buying like the Robin shirt. You're buying the Batman shirt. You know, but he was a whiz with the ball. There, I don't know if there was in his era a point guard I would have rather had leading the charge, trying to get the ball to the right players, right, in the right times, in the right spots. Stockton was the best in the game in his era at that.
Mm-hmm. One thing you said, John, tonight this is going to be a sports podcast. Well, it's also a music podcast. And we're going to be talking about a band. We're going to be talking about a song. And that band is just still one of the most popular British bands to ever be, selling over 120 million albums in their career. We're going to talk a little Dire Straits here tonight.
Well, why are we talking about the Dire Straits?
Because they wrote a song that is featured in this film. This is actually one of the best 80s soundtracks you're ever going to come across.
You missed my bait there, though.
Oh, missed the bait. Jeez.
No, it's all right. I wasn't just calling out like the Dire Straits, like, oh, like, why are we talking about the Dire Straits? But like this soundtrack, you could have picked any song mm-hmm. and any band, and you wouldn't have been wrong. But why are we talking about the Dire Straits tonight?
Because you wouldn't let me talk about Born in the USA. We're talking about Dire Straits because this song very specifically ties into the theme of the film. The song is Money for Nothing. And of course, famously in that song, it's about a blue collar worker watching a wall full of TVs in a department store and watching MTV and thinking the lead singers of these bands have it great. You get money for nothing and the chicks are for free, which is kind of ties into a little bit of the plot of the film.
Well, I think it's funny because if you take this whole money for nothing being about capitalism, and you have a company like Amazon, which is probably the most recognizable brand for capitalism right now, making a movie and being the soundtrack to a movie in and of itself about capitalism. Right, about the sneaker trade, for lack of a better word, right? I'm like, yeah, sure, it's got celebrity, it's got all this stuff, it's got sports, but you know, the nuts and bolts of it are, this is a movie about several meetings where marketers and shoemakers get together to try to figure out how to sell more shoes. That's, you know, this movie in the 90s, if they would have made this, would have starred Al Bundy, and it would have been just, you know, several meetings on how to sell more shoes in a shoe store.
Yep.
but it is so captivating, you know, breaking down like what the plot is or whatever. Ben Affleck has a role in this movie too. He plays the guy who invents Nikes, right? Like when you watch Prefontaine, he's Prefontaine's coach. Right. And now he's Prefontaine's coach, grows up and becomes Batman. He becomes like Batman, who is fallen in love with the Dalai Lama. And now he's very Zen. It's weird because in a lot of ways, he reminds me of Phil Jackson, who would later go on to coach Michael Jordan. But going back to Money for Nothing, the themes of this song, I think, are the epitome of this movie, as great as the soundtrack was, because like I was telling you about this movie and I'm like, first of all, you gotta look at what the soundtrack is for this movie. I think you looked that up before you looked anything up about the movie, and it was just kind of like a holy shit after holy shit moment mm-hmm. for you.
Yep. Let's run through some of the tracks. We have Blister in the Sun from Violent Femmes, Sister Christian from Night Ranger, which I'm sure if we do a little Boogie Nights movie, we could talk about that song. All I Need Is a Miracle, a great single from Mike the Mechanics. Born in the USA from Bruce Springsteen, which actually there's a great story in the film that ties into Born in the USA. You got The Clash, Rock the Casbah, My Adidas from Run DMC, Time After Time from Cyndi Lauper, and Can't Fight This Feeling from REO Speedwagon. Like, just, and Legs from ZZ Top. I've been dying to talk about Legs on every podcast I do, and here we're picking this one movie, and I didn't pick Legs for the song, so I'm still stuck.
Well, and we had talked about that ahead of time, and I think I take part of the blame for that, because I think you were very much on, like, oh, we gotta talk about Legs. I'm like, yeah, but Money for Nothing's right there, and I think you thought about it, and you being the producer among producers were like, I'm going to put my personal, like, desire to talk about Legs aside, mm-hmm. and go, you know what? It really is about what the movie's about, and we need to talk about it.
That's right. And we need to talk about this song, because Dire Straits are one of the biggest bands of the 1980s. Brothers in Arms came out in 1985. And is one of the biggest albums of all time. It sold over 30 million albums, has that iconic cover, had a bunch of singles. This was the main single off this, and it was a mainstay on MTV back in the day. What do you say, John? I even got that video queued up, because everybody knows the video. It's world famous. Let's play a little Money for Nothing from Dire Straits. Already I can hear Scott Haskin going, you're doing the single edit. Yes, we are. The full version of the song is 8 minutes and 22 seconds. The vinyl edit of the song is 7 minutes and 4 seconds. We're doing the official single version, which is 4 minutes and 38 seconds. I hope that's okay, John.
Yeah, no, I love you, Corey, but like, hanging out with you half the time is something I really appreciate.
Understood. I got you. So before you, I know you put up your hand too, Johnny, but I got a question for you. This is a piece of trivia I thought was interesting. That's one of the most iconic guitar intros of any song ever, and one of my all-time favorites. But Mark Knopfler was specifically trying to model his guitar sound after a certain 80s guitarist. Do you know that 80s guitarist whose tone he's trying to replicate?
I mean, this is more like you're on Scott's wheelhouse. Like, what 80s guitarist is he trying to replicate?
Yeah.
I don't know. Prince?
No, but I'm sure Scott's at home right now just screaming the answer. The answer is Billy F. Gibbons from ZZ Top, because ZZ Top were also quite huge in the early to mid 80s. So Mark Knopfler actually called up Billy Gibbons to try and get some tips on replicating that guitar tone. And I'm going to read you the quote from Billy Gibbons. He said, quote, he didn't do a half bad job either, considering that I never told him a goddamn thing.
I mean, look, he doesn't do a bad job. It's, you know, for my money, like you said, one of the most iconic guitar riffs of all time. That leading into the drums, this whole section is one of the most recognizable pieces of music, not only of the 80s, but of all time.
Did not agree more. Is that your thought? You kind of stopped. Okay.
No, that was my whole... I mean, I know you want more out of me, but look, it was your choice to do the 4-minute song and not the 8-minute song. So I'm giving you the 4-minute summary of what I think. So they're going to be shorter thoughts.
And I got to say, I love that you're specifically pausing in weird moments and like freezing. So I think the call freezes, because I'm not cutting anything out because I don't have time. We're just turning this sucker right around and getting it ready to drop Monday morning. So there's another one. That's two. Let's see how many John can force me to do here in the span of a 30-minute show. That's about this point where I expect a voice to say, now look at here, people, listen to my story. A little story about a man named Jed.
We are on such the same wavelength right now. Because as much as I love this song, right, I've probably, you know, heard it more watching UHF than anything else. Because it's a huge part of that movie. And that, you know, that Weird Al's version of this song is as iconic as the song.
In Weird Al circles, absolutely, yeah. Everybody knows Money for Nothing, the Beverly Hillbillies.
If you're not in a Weird Al circle and you understand what Corey just said, then I don't understand why you're listening to this podcast, because this podcast is for Weird Al circles only.
Look at them yo-yos, that's the way you do it. You play the guitar on the MTV. That ain't working, that's the way you do it. Money for nothing and your chicks free.
So that's the song in a nutshell, right? You get up there, rock and roll singers, you know, making Hawaii noises, banging on your bongos like a chimpanzee. That ain't working, but that's the way you do it, and you get your money for nothing and your chicks for free. Because in the 80s, all you had to do was kind of look good, you know, tease up your hair, and that was kind of the deal, right? You got money for nothing and chicks for free.
Yeah, but meanwhile, Mark Knopfler was going off and putting on in all this extra work to try and, you know, replicate the sounds of ZZ Top, when all he needs to do is tease his hair and play his little guitar, and he could have just made the same amount of money.
That's right.
No, that ain't working. That's the way you do it. Let me tell you, damn guys ain't dumb. Maybe get a blister on your little finger. Maybe get a blister on your thumb.
That was always kind of a misconception of mine. This song is sung from the perspective of a narrator, or as a character. And the character is this kind of blue collar worker working in a department store, watching the TVs and saying, it's meant to be kind of, he's admiring these guys. Like, look, those guys ain't dumb. You know, you might get a blister. Absolutely. Just, you know, do whatever you're doing. Even if it ain't working, you're going to get your money for nothing and your chicks for free. So everyone kind of thought he was talking down to, the character in the song was talking down to those guys. He's like, no, that's actually quite smart.
This music video is also, I think, one of my earliest recollections of computer graphics being part of, you know, something with live action and just something in general that I would care to watch, right? Like, this is probably the first computer animation I had ever seen.
Yeah, me too. And apparently Mark Knopfler really had to be sold on the concept. Like, these guys came and said, hey, we could do the whole thing computer generated and kind of tell a story. I think it was his wife actually that told him, there's no interesting videos out there. You should absolutely do this. And then the video became just as iconic as the song.
We got to install microwave ovens, custom kitchen deliveries. We got to move these refrigerators. We got to move these color TVs. To the little faggot with the earring and the makeup. Yeah, buddy, that's his own hair.
So that slur has become a bone of contention nowadays. Obviously, that word is no longer socially acceptable.
And is
that word, of course, is makeup.
Is that me, or is that a slight against George Michael? Because I'm watching this video. I never picked up on it before, but it feels very much like they're trying to emulate like 1985 George Michael here.
In this fake video that they're showing, I think it's a fake video on the TV, potentially. I think he was talking in general.
but I'm listening to even what the lyrics are with the hair, this particular hairstyle and the earring. It feels very much like this was targeted for some reason at George Michael and like almost like a jealousy of what George Michael might have been doing or making at this time financially.
It very well could have been, but when you hear the song, you know, that little, well, Queenie is the word he uses in concert now, not the other word. Well, with the earrings and the makeup, yeah, buddy, that's his own hair. That could have been anybody on MTV in the mid-80s.
Well, yeah, I don't know. If it feels very targeted. It's a very poor choice of lyrics, even for back then. And with a song that I'm enjoying so much, this seems like the angry part of the song and the jealous part of the song.
Yeah. And he meant it as like, a blue collar character might use that word in the 1980s, which is possible, but obviously especially in today's day and age. I know there's actually a controversy in Canada because CRTC banned the song because of that word. You had to edit that word out to play the song on the radio. And there's a couple of radio stations, one in Edmonton, one in Atlantic Canada, that refused to edit it out.
Well, your Toronto Blue Jays just released a relief pitcher for his views on LGBTQT.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Which obviously a different time. And we've talked about this in other shows when you get to problematic humans or problematic lyrics, right? A different time. How does this fit in today's day and age? I know if the song is performed live, or at least in the late 2000s when Mark Knopfler would play it, he replaced that word with Queenie. I don't even know if that's any better actually nowadays. His always thing was, you know, it's satire. It was 1985 and it was satirical. It was never meant to be a slight and that kind of thing. I don't know. Do you give it a pass on those merits, or?
No, I think you give it a pass, but I think you've got to find ways to edit it or contextualize it at this stage of the game. Look, I'm all for free speech, but I'm also for growth and learning, yeah. Right? So if you know, we've learned our lessons from the past, right? Like, then you need to go ahead and actually learn those lessons. You don't have to edit necessarily, but, you know, it is a lyric that is offensive, right? In a lot of ways, whether it's satirical or not. Like, you can hide behind satire. But this, to me, I don't know that this is as much satire as it is just telling a story. And if it's just telling a story, then the character can change a little bit and evolve over the years.
Mm-hmm. The little faggot got his own jet airplane. The little faggot, he's a millionaire. We got to install a microwave oven. So in the video, I just found out here, that's actually it's a band from a different country. I just had it here. Hungarian pop band Elso Emlet. In their video, Alj Vaji Lovak, which is English translation is stop or I'll shoot. That's the video that they're playing on the screens there.
Yeah, I mean that's a choice. I am enjoying these computer graphics of these microwave ovens that is just reversing the animation to make it look like these characters are walking back and forth.
They Flintstone.
And I noticed it because the buttons on the microwave have jumped from side to side as the characters walked from left to right, and now they're walking right to left on the screen. The buttons were on the side that was closest to us.
Yep.
And now it's further, like everything's just kind of like jumping, and it's like this very old school way of just flipping or reversing the graphics.
This must have been really expensive in 1985 to do this video. So I'm sure they cut corners wherever they could, including just flipping the image and reusing it, a la the Flintstones, using the same backdrop, whatever the characters would run in. Just tree already.
Corey, you're an editor. You'll also notice the clipping is a little bit wrong, mm-hmm. in that the back shoulder of the boss is getting overlapped by the video. Which should be in back of him, not in front of him.
Right. Because they put the video. Yeah, exactly.
The layering's a little bit wrong.
Yeah. Different time, my friend. Different time.
I always thought that lyric was, we've got these movies, color TVs. I never realized that they were literally just singing, we've got to move these color TVs.
Yeah, because he's the delivery guy, right? So we got to install these microwave ovens. We got to move these refrigerators, that kind of thing.
Doing this podcast tonight may have ruined this song for me in that, like, lyrics that I've been listening to for 30 years are now going to be completely different in my head.
Well, in that vein, maybe let's talk about the movie a little bit more. I want to talk about Phil Knight a little bit. This is the character played by Ben Affleck, the co-founder and CEO of Nike. And you mentioned at this moment in the film, he's very zen, you know, Dalai Lama, all that kind of stuff. Did you ever see a Michael Moore documentary called The Big One?
I have not.
Okay, in that documentary, they were just closing down the auto plant in his hometown of Flint, Michigan. And he made it part of the film was he was going to try and find a CEO of a big company to reopen a plant in Flint and put all those people back to work. And he actually got an audience with Nike CEO Phil Knight. And Phil Knight agreed to meet with him on camera at Nike headquarters. Pretty much everyone else kicked Michael Moore off the premise, as they probably should. But Phil Knight invited him up. They had a conversation. And Phil Knight said, with all my heart and soul, I truly believe Americans do not want to make running shoes. And so Michael Moore went back to Flint and recorded a video of hundreds of people, out of work people, saying, I will make your shoes. Absolutely, 100%. I want a job. And Phil Knight still would not budge. I believe at the end of the day, my heart of hearts, Americans do not want to make running shoes. And that's, I'll always remember Phil Knight for that. And just that he went, if he was Zed in this movie, he's totally 100% corporate nowadays, because the only reason he's not putting a plant in Flint or anywhere else in America is because he can make them overseas cheaper.
Well, and that this is the reality of the movie, is that Sonny's calling him out for that left and right throughout the course of the movie, of, you know, like, yeah, you hide behind this, but, and it, you know, it's about the dollar, it's about the dollar, it's about the dollar. Prove to me it's not about the dollar, right? And that's a constant thing going throughout the movie. The movie paints him to be a little bit more Dalai Lama and a little bit less corporate America than I think history has proven he is.
Yeah, very true. It also gets right his horrific fashion sense. So that was good. But, and to me, that's a real strength of the script written by Alex Convery. I believe this script was on the blacklist, being one of the best unproduced screenplays. And I can see why. He really weaves a lot of themes in for a period piece that are really kind of relevant today.
Yeah. I mean, look, this movie, for me, I'm going to pull in one of my weird comparisons. But this movie, I think, shares a lot with a movie like 12 Angry Men, in that it's a very small, and Glengarry Glen Ross, it's a very small screenplay. It's a very tight story. It's a character piece. And it works because the screenplay is so tight, right? Like, and that's not taking away the performances and the direction. Like, that all has to be there. But this works because the screenplay is so specific. And it's I hate using the word perfect movie or perfect this or perfect that, but it's a very deliberate screenplay in so many ways. I know that's why this film works. You know, the choice to not show Jordan's face, I'm assuming that was an Affleck call, but I think that works incredibly well. That could have been incredibly cheesy and forced.
And distracting.
I think it's played very well because it's not about him. It's about the rest of the story, and he's there and he's a presence there. I liken it to I saw the movie She Said.
Yes,
and how they carried the presence of Harvey Weinstein in that movie.
Yes.
That he was there and he was a central figure to it, but he is never really shown in full.
Yeah.
And I think that they handled the Jordan character in this equally, if not better, because Jordan would have been distracting to this movie.
100%. And to your earlier point, I think that may have came out of that conversation that Ben Affleck had with Michael Jordan, where he said it's too Jordan-centric. It was more my mom. And so that might have been a byproduct of that. You know what? It would be too distracting. It's like, bad example, it's like putting Luke Skywalker all throughout The Force Awakens. It kind of becomes distracting to whatever kind of story you're trying to tell.
It also solves a big problem, because Jordan's such a recognizable figure that casting him particularly in this movie, I think, hurts the credibility and believability of this movie, because you're probably you're casting either a really good actor who doesn't look enough like Michael Jordan, and it breaks that uncanny valley, or you're casting an actor that looks incredibly like Michael Jordan, but maybe not Michael Jordan at the age appropriate Michael Jordan, like 18-year-old Michael Jordan, or maybe just a terrible actor who happens to look like Michael Jordan, right? So it's really an uphill battle. So I think that by not showing Jordan, they resolved a lot of problems that could have been created by having him be a central figure in the movie.
That's right. And of course, John, you know who that is helping sing backup on Money for Nothing, right?
No.
No? You ever hear of a little guy called Sting?
The Sting?
The Sting.
Like NWO Sting?
No, not that Sting. From the Police. And not the Police Force, from the band The Police.
Oh, that's way different than I was thinking.
Yeah. He actually gets a co-songwriting credit on this because at the end of the song, spoiler alert, he sings the refrain, I want my MTV, but he does it in the same melody as Don't Stand So Close to Me. So because he ripped off his own melody, the record company went after Dire Straits and said he needs co-writing credit. So he got a credit on it.
Oh, that's pretty cool. It's actually, I think I knew that trivia. I knew that trivia like 20 years ago. And, you know, I've told you many a times, I've forgotten more trivia than I remember.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of those pieces.
Gotcha. Well, I just pointed out because Sting was also quite popular at the time. He even got on stage with Dire Straits in 1985 at Live Aid and performed the song with them. So go check that's out that performance. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I mean, Live Aid, just watch the whole concert.
Yeah, except for the Led Zeppelin portion, because you can't. Because Jimmy Page said you can't. I should have learned to play the guitar. I should have learned to play them drums. Look at that mama, she got it sticking in the cameraman. Look at her, so Andy's up there. What's that? Hawaiian noises. He's banging on the bundles like a chimpanzee. Oh, that ain't work. That's the way you do it. Get your money for nothing. Get your checks for free. We got to install a microwave oven. So Michael Jordan was getting some stuff for free, too, if you remember. The different sneaker companies that were courting him. He had a specific car that he wanted, and I think two out of the three guaranteed getting him the car, and they were trying to woo him a whole bunch of different ways. It was kind of cool. We talked about a character piece. Seeing Jay Moore in this film, and a movie that we haven't covered yet, but I can't wait to, is a little movie called Jerry Maguire, where Jay Moore plays like the sleazy disciple agent of Tom Cruise's character. And here he is, and I think he was playing one of the higher-ups. Was it at Adidas, I think?
Yeah, I believe so. You know, it's always good to see him. He plays sleazy so well. You know, it was really appropriate to see him in this movie, especially, you know, associating him so much with Jerry Maguire and the sleazy agent and Jerry Maguire. Yeah, he plays a good bad guy.
Very much so, yeah. Not really a bad guy this one so much, just a guy representing a shoe company. But...
Well, it's the shoe company that we're not rooting for.
Yeah. But it's a movie without really a bad guy, right?
I mean, you say that, but like had Adidas or had Adidas or Converse signed Michael Jordan, the movie would have been about them anyway, right?
Exactly. So it's okay for a movie to not have an antagonist. Look at like Forrest Gump. There's no bad guy in Forrest Gump.
I mean, Jenny's the bad guy in Forrest Gump.
No, she's not. That's his love.
Yeah, you should rewatch that movie.
I think you need to watch it for the first time.
I've definitely seen it a few times. I'm pretty sure Jenny's the villain.
You didn't even fucking know Sting was on Money for Nothing, so I don't take your word for nothing anymore. Custom kitchen delivery. We got to move these refrigerators. We got to move these color TVs. I just noticed that when he puts the severed head of his coworker in the block of ice in the microwave, he set it for 12 minutes.
Yes.
Is that on the defrost setting, or does it take 12 minutes to one thaw ahead?
This was a very old microwave, and they didn't know how to use them back then. They probably had never defrosted a head in a microwave before, so they didn't know how much time it was going to take.
Okay. Well, you don't want to burn it, that's for sure, right? Or...
I mean, you probably can't. It's a microwave. You can't burn things, but you could, like, explode them.
You could burn things in a microwave. Put some tinfoil in there, find out what happens.
Well, yeah, no, that's tinfoil. You're not supposed to do that.
What if I got tinfoil in my hair and you sever my head and put it in the microwave?
If you had tinfoil on your hair, I'd eat my shirt.
Because I don't have hair currently.
Right.
Oh, I gotta say, for our good friend Scott Haskin, he loves it when we watch like the videos with the subtitles on, because little things pop up during the instrumentals. And this whole music, whenever there's a musical interlude, it says "Spirited music continues" or something.
Uplifting,
like that.
Uplifting music continues.
Yeah. Just a little Scott trivia for you folks.
That ain't working. That's the way you do it. You play the guitar on MTV. That ain't working. That's the way you do it. Money for nothing and your chicks for free. Money for nothing. And your chicks for free. Get your money for nothing.
You know, first time I heard that section, I thought maybe that was Billy F. Gibbons. That kind of gravelly voice that Sting's doing there.
Oh, because he's got money for nothing.
Well, the part Sting's doing, and the chicks for free. He's kind of lowering his register and singing a little gravelly. Kind of sounded like Billy Gibbons.
Look, they're doing their best to do their ZZ Top, because you really want to do ZZ Top tonight. And this is as close as we were going to be able to come.
That's right. And very digital. This is another thing about Dire Straits. You know, a lot of synths in the song, but the very first album to be totally recorded digitally was Brother in Arms. That's something I did not know before this evening.
Look at that. Look at that.
Don't stand so close to
me. Close to me.
Spirited upbeat music fades. That's Money for Nothing by Dire Straits from the movie Air. Ah, great song from a really good movie. Go check it out. It's not in theaters anymore. It made about $90 million worldwide, which was its budget, which is pretty good in today's day and age. And doing quite well, I hear, on Amazon Prime. So that's where I checked it out. Go check it out there. Definitely worth the watch. John, anything else you want to say before we wrap it up here tonight?
No, it was a great era for sneakers. I remember, I believe my first Air Jordans were the, I don't know if it was the 4 or the 5. I think it was the 5. So they were already 5 years in. I actually fell in love, because once Jordan got his contract, Nike started signing other players because they had wanted to see if they could replicate it. I got the first Charles Barkley's, which were really comfortable sneakers. They were, I don't think they were Air Barkley's, but they did have the Air in them, like the Jordan technology.
That'd be kind of funny. Air Barkley's, did he ever take to the air?
I mean, no. He did fight Godzilla once.
Did he? In what?
Maybe there was Rodman. Maybe there was Rodman.
Oh.
One of the commercials was either him or Rodman, or maybe they both did fight Godzilla. But I own the Barclays. I did have one pair of Jordans, the 4s or the 5s, really really early on, and great shoes, incredible career, not so great of a baseball career, but that's a story for another show.
Yeah, I don't think they've made a movie about his baseball career yet, but hopefully if they do, they put the song "Legs" by ZZ Top in there so I could finally talk about it. And I never owned a pair of Air Jordans. But I did own quite a few pairs of GWGs, which were great Wayne Gretzky blue jeans, available here in the Great White North. On that note, on behalf of my good buddy John Mariano, my name is Corey Morsa. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time on Backtracks Theme Music.
I'm going to look you in the eyes, and I'm going to tell you the future. You were cut from your high school basketball team. You willed your way to the NBA. You're going to win championships. It's an American story. And that's why Americans are gonna love it. People are gonna build you up. God, are they going to? Because when you're great and new, we love you. Man, we'll build you into something that doesn't even exist. You're gonna change the fucking world. But you know what? Once they've built you as high as they possibly can, they're gonna tear you back down. It's the most predictable pattern. We build you into something that doesn't exist, and that means you have to try to be that thing. All day, every day. That's how it works. And we do it again and again and again. And I'm gonna tell you the truth. You're gonna be attacked, betrayed, exposed, and humiliated. And you'll survive that. A lot of people can climb that mountain. It's the way down that breaks them. Because that's the moment when you are truly alone. And what will you do then? Can you summon the will to fight on through all the pain and rise again? Who are you, Michael? That will be the defining question of your life. And I think you already know the answer. And that's why we're all here. A shoe is just a shoe. Until somebody steps into it, then it has meaning. The rest of us just want a chance to touch that greatness. And we need you in these shoes, not so you have meaning in your life, but so that we have meaning in ours. Everyone at this table will be forgotten as soon as our time here is up. Except for you. You're gonna be remembered forever, because some things are eternal. You're Michael Jordan, and your story is gonna make us want to fly.